like, there are fundamental reasons why the government fails at certain things, which are really hard to eliminate. They're incentive problems.
If you're going to tell me the best we can do is like the U.S. Constitution, I think there's no way. I think there's no way human, like, this is like the top. This is this is the best we can achieve.
We're going to get rid of democracy?
Well, maybe.
We could have more areas patrolled by private security guards. And, like, you know, the government can outsource some of the policing duties, right? And then we could just try expanding that and see how it goes, right? And if it's working, we could expand it more.
Seeing how it goes, I think, with regards to public safety, is a little bit of a cynical prescription. Welcome back to Radius of Reason. This is a podcast about the greatest problems facing humanity. My name is Andre, and I'm joined by my co-host, Ivan.
Naturally, our discussions about addressing these big problems, i.e. the meta crisis, boil down to better systems of governance and coordination. But what if we have it all wrong? What if less government or no government at all is the answer?
To help us answer this question, we're joined to the show by Dr. Michael Humer, who's a professor of philosophy at the University of Colorado at Boulder. Dr. Humer is also an advocate for something called anarcho-capitalism, which is an ideology that advocates the abolition of government functions to replace them with private, market-based alternatives. Dr. Humer, welcome to Radius of Reason. It's good to have you. This is a podcast, as you know, where we tend to discuss the largest, most critical problems facing humanity. So we discuss things like climate change, nuclear war, unregulated deployments of AI. And really at the core, these issues seem to be fundamentally coordination problems. You and your work, you've advocated for various approaches to anarcho-capitalism. For us, it seems that this is fundamentally a position that is inherently incapable of managing these sorts of large-scale coordination problems that we discuss.
Yeah.
How do you feel like your approach, your views, could be deployed to manage some of these existential threats that humanity faces?
Yeah, good. Now, I don't know how much I should go into this, but, you know, you want to distinguish coordination problems from public goods problems. Right. So and these are two different things in game theory. And the difference is with a coordination problem, there are multiple, or there's at least one Nash equilibrium where it's, you know, everybody is doing the thing that's good and everybody has the incentive to continue doing that. And the only reason there's a problem is that you have to decide which good thing to do. Okay, so, like, you know, an example is people are making keyboards for computers and phones or whatever, and it's good if everybody has the same layout. But you have to, they still have to, like, coordinate on which layout to use, okay? But given that there's one that's chosen, everybody has the incentive to continue doing that, okay? A public goods problem is one where everybody's incentive is to defect. Like, everybody's incentive is to do the antisocial thing. And so that's a much harder problem. The free market regularly solves coordination problems. So you notice, like, no government had to make everybody make keyboards with the same layout. There's no law. Like, I can make a keyboard with a weird layout with the keys in all sorts of different places, but I just don't have any incentive to do that. All right. Okay. So, okay.
Hold on. Hold on real quick. Can you provide a non-trivial example? Because I consider that trivial compared to something like a climate change, like a bigger scale thing. Yeah.
Coordination problem. I don't know. You know, language is kind of a coordination problem. Right. So, like, it's good if we can all use words in the same way, and then we get to communicate with each other. Right. And it worked. And, you know, there's, like, many different ways that we could assign meanings to words. But we just need to agree on how to assign it. And then we get huge benefits, like, you know, we get to communicate. Okay, and it's self-enforcing. You don't need a law to tell everybody how to use words because everybody has the incentive to continue, like, once it gets established, to continue doing it the same way other people are doing. Okay, now, public goods problems are a much more serious problem, okay? So, like, the mother of public goods problems is, like, global warming. So, and you might say sort of, like, restraining ourselves would be the public good, right? Or, like, you know, limiting the pollution or something like that, that would be a public good. Because, you know, like, just whatever everybody else is doing, my incentive is to continue to pollute because I get the benefit from that. And I get a small fraction of the cost, So like I'm driving my car and I'm putting pollution into the atmosphere and I'm getting all of the benefit or almost all of the benefit of me driving the car, but I'm getting only like one, whatever, 10 billionth of the cost or less than that, because most of the cost goes on future generations. So I'm getting like 100 billionth of the cost or something like that. So, okay. And so the benefit to me exceeds the cost to me, but the cost to the world as a whole exceeds the benefit on the whole. Okay. So then everybody's incentive is to keep doing that. So we keep doing that. And so then you think, well, we need a government to stop us from doing that. Okay. Now, what's actually going to happen in that particular case? We all know what's actually going to happen, which is we're not going to stop doing it. And we're just going to adapt to the higher temperatures, right? Everybody knows that's what's actually going to happen, right? And so, you know, we're just like...
Yeah, more or less.
The coastal cities are just going to have to build levees to prevent flooding. And like, but by the way, we got a lot of time. Okay, you know, there's just going to be like, you know, a couple feet over the next century. We've got time to do this. Okay. And so it's going to cost some money. Okay. But by the way, we already have government and we're still not going to stop, right? We have a government, but it's still not doing the thing that you say that we need government for, right?
We'll be right back to our discussion with Dr. Humer. But first, we'd like to know if you would like us to explore more topics like this. Let us know in the comments below.
And of course, if you want to support this channel, you can like this video and also subscribe.
So just because there's an agent who could solve a public goods problem doesn't mean that they will.
Well, I mean, I guess in this instance, the agent has like both of its kneecaps broken by like decades of deregulation that it can't even effectively muster up any sort of effective policy to address this issue, right? I think that to me, as I was doing some reading and preparing for this episode, always seems like the greatest tragedy of the arguments against government, where it's never taken at a realistic interpretation of why the government fails at what it does. And I think in my mind, Hurricane Katrina is a great example of that, where oftentimes that's pointed to as like this mass failure of federal government, that FEMA completely dropped the ball. But very seldom is there any deep analysis on how poorly positioned FEMA was to even address that particular disaster through, you know, years of privatization practices by the Bush administration before that.
Well, I don't know what happened to FEMA. I haven't been, you know, reading about FEMA.
It's been a while. Yeah, it's
probably they could have done better.
Like, yes. Okay. Yeah.
Like what? You know, what's the fundamental explanation of why government frequently fails? Like, you know, I mean, there's a couple of things, but you know, one of the things is the incentives for them are not lined up very well. Okay, so if they fail, if they do poorly at their job, they don't lose their job. As a matter of fact, if they do poorly, they usually get more money and more power as a result. Okay, so like an example is if there's a crime wave, so that means the police are failing. Yeah. If there's a crime wave, the police are going to get more funding, not less. Right, and the government is going to get more power, not less. Okay, and that's the way that it works with government. That's not usually the way it works with business. If your business is failing, usually what happens is you go under and your competitors take your market share. But the government doesn't have competitors, so all we can do is give them more money and power.
Well, you could make the argument that, you know, massive public failures of certain institutions do result in job losses in the form of somebody might not get reelected if you have a body of citizens that are actively involved in the political process. Scandals tend to topple entire administrations, in other countries, right?
Right. Yeah. If you have sex with the wrong person, then
well, yes.
I was going to say, I do think largely, you know, Andre and I agree with your criticisms of government. It's just the question is, does that then mean that, you know, we need to move to like a purely free market based type of society, or can we just design better institutions? I mean, you had that paper on revising the Constitution, yes, or coming up with ways to improve it, you know, and I think that was fantastic. You know, you talked about a negative legislature, constitutional court as additions. So I think we want to maybe compare anarcho-capitalism to maybe a slightly more idealistic kind of government system, given what we know and given the trajectory of governments and governmental systems over time. I mean, you, in your book, The Problem of Political Authority, you mentioned that, you know, democracy is an improvement over previous kind of forms of government. And so then the question is like, well, why not try to improve upon that versus, you know, advocate for anarcho-capitalism?
Yeah, why not try to improve on it? Well, you know, just remind you that what we currently have is just about the best that human beings have ever done. Like what we have in the United States and a few other countries, okay, like mostly in Western Europe, is about the best that we've ever done. And, you know, it's still seriously flawed. So we could hope to improve upon it, but yeah. There's also a good chance that we could make it worse while trying to improve on it. And sort of like, you know, like there are fundamental reasons why the government fails at certain things, which are really hard to eliminate. They're incentive problems, right? So we started by talking about public goods problems, but good governance is itself the biggest public goods problem once you establish a government. Okay, so like, it's like, if you're in a democratic society, you're depending upon the voters to vote wisely, to become well-informed, to think rationally, and to put the interests of society ahead of their own personal interests. Okay, and so that's all like public goods. Okay, because for the individual voter, they take the cost. They take the cost of spending time like learning about the issues or trying to overcome their biases, which is emotionally difficult or whatever. They take the cost, but you know, it's a benefit provided for society as a whole, so they only get a tiny fraction of the benefit, right? So it's a public goods problem, so it doesn't get provided, right? So it's like for the same sort of logic as to why you think you need government in the first place is also going to explain why it's not going to work very well. It's very hard to see how you get around this. Like democracy is the best thing that we've come up with, but it's hard to see how you don't have a public goods problem with democracy.
Do you not run into the same problem in a free market? Mm-hmm. It just takes a different kind of form, you know, yeah. Where, you know, a lack of information. Let me backtrack. Actually, maybe you can kind of give us a brief summary of what you actually mean by anarcho-capitalism and like paint a picture so that listeners can kind of understand what we're referring to.
Yeah. So most people don't know what anarchism is, and they think that it means like, oh, total chaos. There's somebody who just wants there to be no rules.
The anarchy of it, yeah.
And that is not what any serious political thinker thinks. Like, nobody thinks we should have chaos. Now, unfortunately, I can't explain this adequately in, like, a couple minutes. But, you know, basically, the anarcho-capitalists think that there are certain functions of government that we need done, but we could privatize them. So, like, police, courts, and lawmaking, we could privatize those. Okay, so instead of having a single monopolistic police force like we have in our cities, you could have multiple competing security agencies. And then, you know, maybe you hire one or maybe your homeowners association hires one. Okay, and then, you know, instead of the government monopolistic court system, there could be competing arbitrators. Right? And so if you have a dispute with somebody, then you and the other person have to, you know, find one of these competing arbitration companies to resolve your dispute.
So it's like almost, I'm not trying to like reduce your argument to anything, but it's almost like a protection racket, different like mob families like competing for which barbershop they're going to be.
You know, like it's not any more or less like that than the government, right?
Yes.
So,
yeah.
So this is what I want to kind of explore. You talked about how, you know, the incentive to, you know, do research on a policy or a certain politician that you are thinking about voting for, the incentive is very low because your vote hardly counts, right? So the incentive to do all this research and to be able to pick the best one, it's very low. In a system where you've now that choice is with regard to choosing various agencies for maybe security or you know, choosing where to live, seeing how an HOA, you know, kind of manages things. Are you still not prone to the same issue of like misinformation and being able to spend the time to choose things and kind of going with like what a lot of other people, like a lot of people are choosing this agency, therefore it must be good. It seems like, you know, it's prone to the same issues that you would have in a democratic election. No?
So, you know, people always have problems of ignorance and making mistakes periodically. Right. But so like there isn't a perfect system, but you can have better and worse systems. And one of the like really key things is to have incentives aligned. So in the market, normally you have the incentive to choose the best provider. Because like if you figure out who the best provider is, then you get that provider. Right? You patronize that business, you give them your money, and you get their product. In the democratic process, you spend all this time figuring out who the best provider is, like who's the best candidate, and then you do not get that person. Right? After all the effort that you did, you still get what the majority of other people voted for.
Well, I mean, but then it leaves room for, you know, groundwork, for campaigning. Like in theory, like in a perfect vacuum, you could channel a vast amount of effort, organize people, and achieve the result you want to achieve.
Yeah, yeah.
Of course, now, yeah, so, you know, the cynic would say, you know, money has captured politics.
If you're unhappy with a politician, there is a non-zero chance that you can get that person kicked out and get somebody else. But the costs of doing that are just vastly higher than the cost of switching a normal product in the market. And the odds of success are much lower. Right. And so the incentives are just not so good. Right.
Yeah. I mean, I probably grant you that. Although I think humans are so irrational and can be swayed by so many things that it's not clear to me that even in a free market, they would meet the threshold of like, okay, I've actually made the choice that's in my best interest and all that. But let's just grant that for a second. I mean, let's talk about negative externalities for a second. I mean, this is all tied together with the public goods issue and everything we've talked about. Yeah. But let's consider like an example of some business polluting, you know, the river. Yes. And a town downstream is now getting hit with pollution, which causes with toxins, which cause cancer and so on. You know, we've encountered these issues before, and government has actually done something. Like, it has worked. So this is an example where I think, okay, this is great. Like, government isn't perfect, but we have made progress where a lot of the laws that we've created, well, I don't know if a lot, because we have a lot of laws, which you frequently point out in the book, but we have, like, very tangible successes with certain kind of restrictions we've imposed through government. So, you know, the environmental protection is like one of the, I think, great successes to the extent that it, you know, locally speaking, obviously globally it hasn't worked as well, but how would a free market scenario play out with that if you envision it trying to address a problem like that?
Yeah, I mean, so, you know, there are different kinds of environmental problems, and some of them we would have solutions for, and some of them we wouldn't. So, you know, if somebody's dumping pollution in a fairly localized area, so like the anarcho-capitalist envision there being a court system. It's not a monopolistic governmental court system, but it would, you know, this private competitive whatever system of arbitration. So you would raise a dispute. Like if you're one of the victims, you can start a dispute with whoever is putting the pollution, right? And okay, and now it doesn't work so well with something like global warming, because in that case, the victim is everyone. And also most of the victims are in the future, so they can't bring a court case. And also the perpetrators are everyone. So like it's probably not going to work for that, but it would work for cases where the pollution is localized and there's a definite group of victims and there's a distinct definite perpetrator, right? Okay. So you raise a dispute with them, and then, you know, if you like the arbitrator finds that, yep, you're right, you know, the other person was wrong, then they would issue some decision, right? And then you have the private security companies that would be then there to enforce the decision. So they would have to pay. They'd have to pay compensation for the harm that they caused to specific individuals. And that compensation should be enough to deter them if the benefit that they got was less than the harm that they caused.
Okay. What about corruption ensuing from the business paying off, you know, the arbitration for, you know, like how do you, I mean, that's something that, you know, that happens in government. you know, all the time, you know, like DuPont, after they released a ton of, you know, toxic forever. Yeah. The forever chemicals. They were paying off not just the government, but scientists in academia.
Yeah.
So that the consensus view would shift in their favor. Why would it be any different, I guess, in this anarchist system?
There's no perfect society as long as you have human beings. Human beings are flawed, so things are going to be flawed. So you just have to ask what would be better or worse, right? But like there's the, if the government goes bad, or like if the government is corrupt or whatever, you know, what is your recourse? They're a monopoly by definition. So you don't have any alternative, right? Like if the court system is failing, too bad, you still have to use them. And with a free market system or with a competitive system, if a particular arbitration company is failing, if they're known to be corrupt or, you know, they're really slow, really expensive, et cetera, well, they have competitors. And so like people are more likely to go to their competitors. They're likely to lose market share, right? Like the key asset for an arbitrator is their reputation for fairness, right? Because what you have to have is like, you have these two parties who have a dispute and they can't agree upon very much, but they have to agree upon the arbitrator. And so you need to have a reputation for being strictly impartial and fair, and you're just going to blow that up. Now, in the case of the government, they don't have to have that. They do not need to have a good reputation because they have a coercive monopoly.
But we don't really have positive examples of that in the private sector as is. I mean, right off the top of my head, you have Lockheed Martin makes the F-35 warplane. The F-35 is notorious that it does like everything except fly combat missions, right? Like it falls into various bodies of water. It catches on fire. It, you know, randomly ejects its pilots. But Lockheed Martin continues to win contracts. So we have an example of how this kind of system is going to play out, right?
Well,
the arbitration court, you know, could be a totally corrupt entity, but
I mean, it seems like your examples are examples of government failure.
Lockheed is a private company, but
their main customer is the government, right? So, and like the a private company, like I don't know anything about this airplane that you're talking about, right? But it does sound like if they were producing this for a private company, they'd be out. Like if a private company would not keep patronizing somebody whose product was not satisfactory.
Yeah, I don't think that was a great example, Andre. I think a lot of your arguments in the book are predicated on a certain conception of human nature, where we're going to do the rationally self-interested thing. But it just seems like a very stripped down, like conveniently stripped down to favor anarcho-capitalist societies type of view, because, you know, humans have emotions, they have tribal affiliations, they have status competitions, they have all these other things that end up resulting in less than rational, less than optimal for my self-interest type of decisions. So, I guess, can you speak to that a little bit? How did you come to that view of human nature, and like, what evidence do we have that, you know, humans are doing the optimally self-interested, rational type of thing?
I've noticed a lot of people being selfish. but you know, by the way, if people were less selfish, fine, it's going to go even better, right? Sometimes people will be irrational, like they'll still be selfish, but irrationally so. Okay, and how does that make government better?
Right. So you can design government like systems to try to account for that, whereas the free market doesn't have those guardrails, right? That's like the intrinsic difference.
If people are irrational, why wouldn't the people in the government be irrational too?
No, in the government, you are counting on them being irrational, which is why in theory, like you try to develop a system of governance that has guardrails to account for that built in irrationality.
Oversight.
Right. Like, if you will. Yeah. So like We know this works because we know that, you know, like the U.S. Constitution is an improvement over certain other forms of government. So we know that by implementing certain types of systems, you can actually improve people's ability to coordinate, to change the incentives so that there's, you know, certain checks and balances. And I think, so from that standpoint, like, if we talk about government, we actually, in theory, have a mechanism to bind some of the irrationality to produce kind of better outcomes. Whereas in a free market, you simply are reliant upon whatever just happens, right? Given the base human nature.
So, like, no? I don't know what we're talking about. Like, what irrationality are you talking about that we have a remedy for with government? That, like, people something that's just harmful to everyone just because they're being stupid or something.
I think it goes back to something like a climate change where, and I know government's not doing a great job at the moment, but I think you can envision a system of government that in theory could, whereas I don't really envision anything in an anarchist system in theory that could handle something like climate change. So
that's not anything about irrationality, right?
Let me just regain my train of thought, because I was trying to get to a concrete example. So you mentioned the thing about how, because the negative externalities are hard to see and also in the future, that it's kind of difficult for, you know, to account for. And that's absolutely true. But if you have a government where you've elected, let's say, decision makers that are actually thinking long term, where you maybe create institutions and systems that have incentives to plan for long term outcomes, then now you sort of have these guardrails against the short term self interest, right? Yeah. Because you've created systems that try to prioritize long term outcomes. Yeah. And so.
But you're just stipulating that and not describing a mechanism that would actually do that, right? And
it's a hard work. It's hard work to come up with a mechanism, but I think, you know, how many people are trying? What was that?
What we actually have is we have democracy, and basically the politicians only care about the next election cycle. And if a problem is going to occur after they're out of office, then they don't care about it. But by the way, there are incentives for companies to take into account the long-term future. Right. Because, like, you know, just in economic theory, the value of your company today is it's dependent upon the entire, you know, predictable future of the company. Right. So, like, you know, if the company is going to lose money in 100 years, its stock price goes down now if it's predictable. And there's nothing like that with the government. Like, the politicians could be seeing this disaster that's coming. But as long as the time that it hits is going to be after they're out of office, they don't care.
I mean, but I think that kind of, to me, if that were the case, and I'm not disagreeing with you that, you know, our current manifestation of a democratic system is in fact staffed, led, and populated by politicians that only care about the next election cycle. I think that is an accurate observation, but I think it's an observation that doesn't take into account the greater scope of the evolution of democracy. To me, this is more of like a unique moment in American political history, or even global democratic history, because I think it's a problem that all democracies face right now. But no political system would have survived up to this point if its participating politicians only cared about that 4-year window, right? I think this is a unique moment in which our leadership is hyper-focused on this. But I do think that centuries of effective government in the U.S. does indicate that we do think beyond just the scope of like the barrel of the next election.
Oh. Sure, that's true.
Okay.
Well, so just, you know, just think about the sort of evolutionary process, right? It's like there are some politicians who only care about the next election cycle, and then there's another politician who cares about the long-term future. There's going to be this sort of evolutionary process where the people who just think about the short term get reelected. Because by definition, right? They're the people who are doing what it takes to get reelected next, and the people who are thinking about the long-term future don't.
Right, and, right, and maybe that just speaks volumes to maybe reforming an existing system that we
well,
have,
well, that's
right?
An issue with democracy. Yeah, it's a short-term popularity contest with the way it's currently set up.
And I think it goes back to what Levon said earlier, that in its essence, we agree with the criticisms you offer up. I think they're very valid criticisms. I just think the solution that at least I see is to reform the structures we currently have.
Yeah, and I think it's unfair for you to criticize government as is. I mean, we also criticize government as is because you're proposing a system that's, very much theoretical.
Yes.
But you're comparing it to the obvious flaws in the existing system, whereas we're saying, hey, there's also this other theoretical system of government which tries to realign the incentives
But I don't see what this other possibility is. We're going to get rid of democracy?
So there's this, I don't know if I mentioned this, the idea of sortition, where you randomly kind of draft decision makers.
Yes.
I mean, this has been tried in various societies. I think even in the past and in some Greek state at one point. But there's various systems. And look, I'm not going to sit here and say I know which one is the best, but you shouldn't rely on a couple of podcasters to come up with this new governmental system.
Inevitably that's what's going to happen. Inevitably, that's the future we're heading to.
Yeah, we're not going to Joe Rogan our way to a superior, political systems. But if more of our brightest people spent time thinking about systems and ways to improve them, I think we could certainly come up with something much better than what we have now. And if we did, that would be the comparison that I would want to make between a free market-based society and a society that has guardrails to account for some of the flaws in human nature. That's all I'd say.
Well, so it's hard for me to assess a system that we don't know what it is, and to argue that something is better than that.
Well, let me propose something concretely then. Let's because I don't want to. Yeah, I don't want to just keep it super abstract where we can't really make any progress on it. So let's consider the idea of sortition, this idea that, you kind of randomly draft decision makers, right? And then let's say you add a couple of things to this to spice it up. Let's say you have multiple rounds where the people that are drafted then choose someone that they believe would be a good leader, let's say for a given topic or just in general. And then those people that have been nominated are then drafted randomly as well. So you have tiers of that, but then to be drafted at all, you have to qualify based on certain parameters. Hey, I work 10 years in industry, and I'm I'm at least 35 years old. I'm, younger than 65. Hopefully we have an age cap there. You add some basic parameters where you're we're not just drafting anyone. We're trying to draft people that have contributed to society in some meaningful way that aren't just, they don't get to make key decisions just because they exist. They've earned, it's kind of a meritocracy almost of hey, I've earned my value in being able to be drafted, my qualification to be drafted. So in such a system, you bypass the popularity contest issue. You bypass the short-term incentives because you're not running for election. And maybe you have obviously you could still have term limits and so on. That bypasses certain issues. I'm sure it creates, a host of, other issues, but it may be, less than the existing.
So I want to say democracy, even though I'm criticizing democracy, it's the best form of government that people have come up with. And what it does do, you don't really have the incentive to take into account the long-term future, but it does do one thing, right? Which is that there are the incentives to avoid obvious, widespread, near-term disasters. Okay, so if you're in office and there's a famine and millions of people die, you're getting kicked out. Okay, now that seems kind of a low bar, but actually, That's the best we've come up with, because in other systems of government, like in dictatorship, they don't even stop the short-term widespread obvious disasters, right? They don't even prevent the famines or like millions of people dying, whatever. Okay, so like that's the benefit of democracy. And now, okay, now if you have this thing where people are getting randomly selected and they didn't even want to be in office, they don't even have the incentive to prevent the obvious near-term disasters. You see what I mean? Like,
I mean, I think that's a very pessimistic view of human nature. I mean, the idea is you'd be selecting enough people. The idea is you would select enough people that, you know, you create this assembly where, sure, you're going to have a few bad apples at least, right? But you're betting on the majority being reasonable, non-psychopathic individuals, which I think is borne out by statistics. So I'm not sure, I buy that.
Yeah, no, only 3% of the population are psychopaths.
Right.
Okay, but, and also, like, the people in Congress are not really psychopaths. So, like,
their incentives are aligned such that they seem to behave as psychopaths, whereas in this system, I don't think that would necessarily be the case.
Well, no, but, like, you know, where are the better incentives? So, like, in the current system, they at least have the incentive to avoid obvious near-term disasters, right? And in the...
Yeah, but they have...
System, they don't even have that incentive. Right, because
I think a decent human being with like a reasonable level of intelligence and like just some experience living as a human being in a society and like doing some meaningful contributions, like that already puts, in my view, that already, regardless of incentives, like just as a human being, like without the perverse incentives that government officials tend to have, I think that puts you in a better spot. So. Yes, there's maybe more positive incentives in the current system that we have, but the negative incentives, the corruption, the lobbying, and so on, take you down like below, I think, default human expectations, right? That's kind of the way I view it.
I think the reason, like, we're grappling with like two theoretical situations here, like, on both sides of the conversation, and I think really the nerve center of everything is that yes, our current system is flawed, but it is flawed because of a very well documented, strongly explained scenario of deregulation, right? So I don't even think we should be talking about like some like revolutionary anarcho-capitalism approach or a draft-based system to produce like the next technocracy. But really, it's just restoring some of the regulations in place that allowed our government to effectively function as it did during, let's say, the Great Depression, right? That were you empowered? It was a shit time for a lot of people involved. But I think the state at that time, you know, you had a great example of previous administrations prior to FDR weren't able to effectively tackle the crisis. They were voted out. FDR was moved into office based on the promise that he could do something better. And he started implementing policy that was alleviating a lot of the suffering that the majority of the population was going through, in addition to addressing a very present environmental disaster that the country was facing at the time.
I think that's totally backwards. It was like, you know, President Hoover didn't do a great job. Okay. And the Federal Reserve probably turned what was going to be a normal recession into a depression. We started the Federal Reserve to prevent depressions, and the first thing they did was cause the greatest depression. But anyway, then FDR took over and he's just doing all kinds of crazy shit. And it was like, the crisis goes on for 10 years, you know, the worst ever in our history. And then everybody's like, wow, what a great job. You know, like if anybody who wasn't in government did that badly, you know, they were sent in during a crisis and the thing went on for 10 years and was the worst that the country had ever seen. Nobody would say great job. If this was a private company, they'd be fired.
Is that the consensus among economists? Is that, I'm not as familiar with either of you on this, but is that what?
I don't know. I know that Milton Friedman had written about this, and the stuff that I said about the Federal Reserve, I think that's fairly well accepted. Like, they did the opposite of what they should have done.
Under Hoover?
Yeah, I'm not sure how long it went on. I think they restricted the money supply when they should have increased it. But, you know, according to standard monetary theory. But, you know, all the things that FDR was doing, I don't know if there's a study of the effects of it, but just sort of like the logic of this, he was just doing crazy things like people are starving and he's paying people to not grow food. And there's like stuff that's just on the face of it crazy.
I think he was paying them to not grow food in a certain way because they're trying to reform agriculture practices to adapt and move past.
He was trying to prop up prices because there was deflation. But that's not the way to do it. Because he was just like experimenting. And it's like, oh, let's just try some stuff out and see what happens.
Well, it seemed like he had a pretty concentrated approach to practice the kind of the Keynesian economic model through his administration, right? Established things like Social Security. He propped up Americans that were unemployed, that didn't have enough money to eat.
Yeah.
I think all of like the you know, whatever rays of light that shine through John Steinbeck's novels, that's all like that's the New Deal program coming into effect. So I think for the average destitute American to have a state apparatus that actually functioned in support of their best interest, it was a unique moment, and I think it was a very effective moment.
Okay, we're not going to agree about FDR. Like, you know, one of the worst presidents in history. Anyway.
Hot take.
So the other thing, like, okay, so, you know, I'm frequently down on our politicians, okay? But our politicians do have there's some good things, like they are smarter than the average person. They're going to have a higher IQ and they're going to have more education. Yeah. And if you start
people, yeah, bad time to say that with Trump in office, but yeah.
Well, he's still higher IQ than the average person. Although, well,
which is, I guess that's scary. That's even more depressing.
Yeah, although he's more immoral. He's less moral than the average person. But anyway, like when all this stuff that he's doing, like, you know, he's saying crazy shit, but it's not because he's stupid. Okay. It's because he's
a man just really wants Greenland.
He's manipulating his base. Okay. Anyway, let's not go off on that. But anyway, you start choosing like random people. I don't know. Just going back to the sortition, but you know, you start choosing random people, you're going to get lower IQ people. And like, it really matters if you think that getting the right policies is difficult. It requires thinking and knowledge. If you think that the right policy is obvious, then it's fine to just get some person of goodwill.
No, I mean, these people that are drafted can also, you know, they can form committees of experts that can give them, you know, the various policy options and what the pros and cons are. And I think the biggest obstacle to choosing the right policy is not IQ. I think it's the perverse incentives to not choose them because of corporations or lobbying efforts and so on. I think that's the biggest obstacle. So I do think, you know, you want intelligent people, but intelligent people, like the decision makers, don't necessarily have to be the smartest people in the room. They just have to be less bound to corrupt forces, you know. And I think that system eliminates much of the corruption that you see. I'm sure people, you know, people will find some way to corrupt that as well to a certain degree. I just think it's, you know, I also think it needs to be coupled with more transparency in government and so on. But I mean, we could talk about that.
Like the flaws of democracy are tied to its benefits, right? Like the reason why did anybody come up with democracy in the first place? Why is it supposed to be a good idea? So it's, well, like, you know, if you're doing a bad job, then like a bunch of the public are going to be harmed by what you're doing and then they will want to vote you out. Okay, and like that's a really important bit of the incentive structure. Like that's what's supposed to stop people from screwing up. And if you don't have to worry about being voted out, then you know what's the incentive, right?
I mean, you could probably create a mechanism of like recalling the drafted members if they're doing an especially bad job. I mean, you could find ways to account for that. You could also, I mean, you could even add punishments to doing that job.
Yeah,
Bring back the guillotine, you know?
Yeah, 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 right before we started recording, I was reading about like the old Saxon way of governance where they would sacrifice their king at the end of their tenure. Like, hey, good job. Now go, like, pay your respect to the gods. And that was just like, huh, interesting. Like, you take your centerpiece, like, authoritarian source of power, and then you kill them at a certain point.
What could go wrong? You know, I guess they would probably spend their whole time trying to figure out how to stop themselves from getting killed, right? Anyway.
Yeah, I mean, which is a great incentive.
You know. Yeah, you do a good job. Yeah,
yeah, but I mean, we could talk about this all day. I think the point, though, is if you're going to tell me the best we can do is like the U.S. Constitution, I think there's no way. I think there's no way human that this is like the top. This is the best we can achieve. And if that's and if you accept that, then I think you would want to compare anarcho-capitalism to whatever, you know, a more improved model. In which case, I don't think it's obvious at all that leaving things to the free market is better, especially when, I mean, I guess to go back to the human nature thing. So. From evolutionary psychology, we know that, you know, humans are built for not happiness, not well-being, but like survival and reproduction, right? Yeah. Now, it just so happens in the past that was more aligned in many ways. But in modern society, that's not necessarily the case, right? You have all these different kind of forces that hijack your limbic system and give you kind of short-term gratification that's not tied to more long-term benefits. Where was I going with this? I guess yours. So your model of human nature, it supposes that humans again are kind of these self-interested rational beings, but like, you know, then we have behavioral economics, which kind of, I think, shows that's not necessarily the case. Yeah. So we have people that are not necessarily rational, but then also we know that what's in your self-interest doesn't necessarily lead to well-being and happiness, which I think most people would say, like, we want societies that would maximize well-being and happiness, right? And not necessarily freedom. Like your system maximizes freedom, right? You would contend like that would be one of the values or virtues of your system.
Yeah.
So is it worth? Yeah. Well, I was just gonna say, sorry, go ahead.
People sometimes make mistakes, right? So economists are predicting what some firm is supposed to do. They have this great theory if the people in the firm are rationally self-interested, whatever. But people also make mistakes, okay? But there is sort of like an evolutionary process where in the market, the people who make a lot of mistakes get eliminated, right? Or they lose market share, so they get control of fewer resources, and the people who don't make a lot of mistakes get control of more resources, right? But the government is a monopolistic system, right? So like they can keep making mistakes and they can keep operating. Right. So like that, you know, even the problem of irrationality is worse with the government, right? Like, you know, if we're talking about irrationality, yeah, you just like reasoned incorrectly and just did the thing that, right, that didn't make sense.
Yeah. So I guess what I was trying to get at, because we have touched on this particular issue earlier, but the idea of like paternalism, that the government might know better than people. So, I mean, we both, I think, would say we want decision makers that are higher than average IQ, right? Like that would be ideal. so right there, it already seems like by deferring authority to people with higher IQ, they could potentially make better decisions for the whole group. So like that's one where you've got maybe an increase in decision making that, although may not even appear in someone's self-interest, a certain politician might be advocating for a policy that someone says, oh, I don't like that, but it might actually benefit them. So one example is like seatbelt laws, right? So before the government, before seatbelt laws and also seatbelt like campaigns to promote seatbelt usage, I think it was like 14% of people were using seatbelts. But then when it became mandatory, 85% of people were using them. So, okay, 14% of people using them, like that's, you know, that's the number, that's the ratio of people that thought it was rational and in their self-interest to do so. Whereas it clearly, you know, should be a much higher percent. It should be 100%, right? Like if your model of human nature was right, it should be closer to 100% than 14%. But with the government advocating for this, it's 85%. So is that, I mean, what do you have to say about that example? Is that, it seems like a microcosm of the issue that I'm trying to illustrate.
Well, it's hard to say. There's a small risk, you know, every time you drive, there's a small risk that you're going to have a crash. And if you have a crash, then you're better off wearing the seatbelt. But if you don't have a crash, you're better off not wearing the seatbelt. You know, like, and I don't know how uncomfortable it is for people. So I wear my seatbelt and I recommend wearing it. But, you know, maybe if it's really uncomfortable for you, like it's not worth it, you know, and you're, you know, having a low risk.
Here's a problem, though, because the people that don't put their seatbelts on and they get in accidents and they need medical care. Now, the insurance companies are paying more to treat that person so that like insurance premiums for everyone can go up because of someone's less than rational decision. And that's where those like second order consequences, I think, is where the free market view starts to struggle, in my opinion, where you can have government actually try to account for those, even if it's sometimes ineffective.
So, I mean, I don't know about this specific example, right? But in general, the insurance companies try to price your insurance according to your risk factors. So in general, if you're doing risky things, then they would try to raise your premiums and for, you know, all the people who are doing risky things. Now, they can't get everything, right? But like if they're, okay, they have the incentive to try to take that into account. And it's a self-interested incentive, which is more reliable than, you know, relying on the government to be altruistic and to care about the welfare of the people, right? So, right. So, you know, like, I mean, I don't know about this specific example, but sort of like this general thing that like, well, why does the government care about you? Like, so there are people in government who are higher than average IQ. And so like, they might be better able to figure out what's good for you if they had the knowledge about your personal life, but they also don't particularly care about you because they're strangers to you.
Well, I mean, they're strangers in like a sense of a monolith, but if you start breaking it down into like composed elements, like technically speaking, if you elect a representative, they're not entirely strangers to you because in essence, they still have to face you down during town halls. You elect them because of a particular reason or a set of issues that's impacting your community that you want to be carried over to Congress, right? So that like as a monolith, yes. I don't know anything about the senator from Texas. He doesn't give a shit about what's happening to me in Illinois. But my own congressman, my own senator, that's less of an impersonal relationship there.
Have you ever met your congressman?
I have.
Yeah.
Andre's an anomaly, though. He's not a good example.
So, like, I've never met any of my representatives or any of the politicians.
But that's not the fault of the system, right? That comes down to
Well, initiative. I don't know if I agree with that, Andre. I think
like it's a large society. There are millions of people. There's just no way that they could know about
individuals. They can't. I'm not saying on a personal level, right? I'm not making the case that, you know, Congressman X, Y, or Z needs to know every single
person. Well, So they have the incentive to some degree.
Right,
but this is what we were saying earlier. Like, they have the incentive to care about avoiding short-term, obvious, widespread disasters. Okay, and the reason I say those three things is if it's long-term, then the disaster will happen after they're out of office, so they won't get blamed for it. Okay, if it's not obvious, if something bad is happening, but it requires kind of subtlety or requires like doing research to figure out that the bad thing is happening, you know, like most of the voters are not going to know about that, so the politician won't have the incentive to worry about that, right? and then widespread. So if there's a problem that it's only affecting a small number of voters, and, you know, like if there's something that's like it's good for the majority, but it's harmful to the minority, you know, like in democracy. Okay. But still, they do have the incentive to avoid it. Like, it's all these things. It's widespread. It's obvious and it's near term. Then they have the incentive to avoid that. I agree with that.
I mean, but certain issues like have been propelled to the forefront of politics that politicians have to take into account. Like, I think like the Gaza situation is a good example of that. I mean, that was one of this. Like, I mean, I don't. This is more of my own analysis of it. But I think one of the things that really did harm Kamala Harris in the previous election was the fact that the entire state of Michigan was bristling at how. Well, not the entire state of Michigan, but a large percentage of the Michigan voting bloc were bristling at how the Biden administration was handling the situation between Israel and Gaza. And that is now something that I think subsequent politicians will have to take into account when running for election, be it at the executive level or the legislative level. So this issue is pervasive and it's outlasting, I think, the individual term or tenure of a single elected official.
Oh, good. Yeah. So it's not all just your self-interest, because, like, you know, there are issues that people care about that might not be about themselves personally. So there's also ideology, right? And sometimes it could be good and sometimes it could be bad. Okay. So, like, there could be something that a large number of voters care about for, like, ideological reasons. And I'm not using that pejoratively, but just like, you know, they just have beliefs about what would be good about society, not necessarily for them personally.
Right.
Okay. And sometimes the voters are correct, in which case then there's an incentive for the politicians to do the right thing. But also the voters don't have very strong incentives to try to be correct. Right. So if getting the ideology right is difficult, then they will probably not get it right. So then the politicians could be incentivized to sort of like act according to the incorrect ideological views, right? It's not really obvious, right? Like how things shake out overall, like whether this is overall good or bad, right? But by the way, like in that particular case, it's like, well, there's no way to make everybody happy. It was just like there wasn't anything that the Biden administration could have done that like they wouldn't have been attacked by large numbers of people.
Sure, but I mean, at that point, I think you do have to listen to your voter base, right? Or I mean, maybe not the Biden administration specifically, but like an individual congressman or a senator, like you do have to start taking into account the grievances of the people that elected you from your respective district.
Just try to satisfy the majority. But you know, like, I mean, that won't necessarily be what's actually right, you know.
But I mean, is democracy about, I don't know if I'm going to agree with this statement, but I mean, it's on the tip of my tongue, but is democracy about being right, or is democracy about exercising the will of the people that are participating in the process?
So the incentive for the politician is to give the people who voted them in what they want, right? Or at least appear to give them what they want, or whatever, say that you're giving them what they want. Okay, but what they want might not be what's actually good, you know. And like what if the majority wants to exploit the minority? Right, so then you have the incentive to do that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I guess in a free market, you know, you also have probably majorities exploiting minorities. I mean, so we've been talking a lot about hypotheticals and abstract scenarios. How about we try to touch grass a little bit and talk about the historical, like just everything that's happened throughout human history? And
yeah, let's talk about everything that's happened in human history.
Let's just talk about, it's more concrete.
Far easier topic to digest.
But so the course of human history, to me, suggests that if you don't have state systems, state-based systems, you will get outcompeted. So if you start at a small scale with like certain tribes, right? Like those tribes are going to get outcompeted by bigger tribes that are more coordinated because they've got some centralized authority, and then chiefdoms and then so on. Like at every step of the way, it seems like there were probably societies that more or less resembled, you know, something like anarcho-capitalism, because especially at a small scale, you don't have this massive issue of anonymity and transparency and all these things like that. That's, you know, the signals are a lot more clear. Right. And so you might have these societies like in isolation functioning well, and I do believe they would, you know, at a small enough scale. But once you grow larger, and then also once you start competing with other societies, I think that's where you really have a problem. Because even if anarcho-capitalism is the sort of ideal society in a vacuum, the moment you pit it against centralized authoritative states, you know, then I think, you know, you can really fall to their, you know, military prowess. Is the kind of the way I view
it. Aztecs facing down the Spanish Empire.
Yeah, well, they, the Aztecs aren't, they weren't an anarchist society. Yeah. You know, they were like technologically way behind Spanish. Okay. So, you know, like one thing, so we don't have any real examples of anarcho-capitalism such as the ANCAPs are envisioning in history. And you might think, oh, why is that? Maybe that's because it doesn't work, or like, you know, maybe it's infeasible. But, you know, notice that, like, I don't know, at the time that the United States was started, you might have said, look, there are no democracies. They tried it before in ancient Greece. It didn't work out. So democracy obviously is unstable. We shouldn't try this. And then I just think, no, like, you know, humanity evolves over time. It might be that there's a, you know, we evolve from dictatorship. We evolve first from primitive tribes and then to states with dictatorships and then to democracy. It might be that there's a stage beyond that. And it might, in fact, be that you have
Hold on, though. Are not the primitive tribes resembling many core aspects of anarcho-capitalism in the sense that, I mean...
So it's not like it's not considered, they're not considered states in the modern sense. So that, you know, if you talk to political theorists, they would say that was a pre-state society, right? But it didn't have the institutions that the anarcho-capitalists are envisioning, right? They would have a tribal chief or something. So it's kind of like having a small dictatorship. Okay. But they're superseded by like these bigger, whatever, more organized dictatorships. So
did they try to build one in Eastern Ukraine in 1917, like the Makhnovshchina, the Green Army that was trying to carve out an independent path away from like this, the Bolsheviks and the white movement in Russia. And they tried to form some sort of like anarchist utopia in Eastern Ukraine. But like to Levon's point, they were very quickly just absolutely decimated by like the sheer.
So I know nothing about this story, but most anarchists historically have been socialist anarchists. And I really don't think that socialist anarchism makes sense. Okay. But anyway, so like
a contradiction.
Who's going to stop people from accumulating private property and capital? There's an anarchic society, and then there's like there's a state, and the state could take over the anarchic society. They have a powerful military. And this is really true. If you're in an anarchic society, it's going to be hard to raise a powerful military. So like it could be individuals who have guns, like in America, like, I think America has like, you know, more guns than any other country in the world, like per capita. But anyway, they're these individuals with their AR-15s, right? But they're not going to be able to match like the U.S. military. Okay. But by the way, I'd like to point out that there are many state societies that are that have a similar power imbalance. Like, right, there are many cases of states that are much less powerful than other states. So, you know, like the United States is bordering on Canada. And like the Canadian military is no match for the U.S. military.
Right. But you would need to compare, you know, population size, like, right. You need an apples to apples comparison. Like if you had, you know, if China was an anarcho-capitalist society and the U.S. wanted to take over, look, I mean, could they, if they try to take over in the way that they try to take over Afghanistan and Iraq, like, sure, it would fail, but if they really just wanted to wipe them off the map and take their shit, they could.
I mean, Afghanistan is a great example of a smaller insurgency being able to fend off a much stronger...
Right, but I think the objective is I think you need to see, you need to consider what the objectives are, right? That's what I'm saying. Like, if the U.S. just simply just wanted the resources, they could have gone in and killed everyone in Afghanistan and Iraq and taken all the oil.
But I think that's the problem, is they couldn't have killed. They tried to eradicate the Taliban movement, but
no. I'm saying everyone. They could have flattened that place and just taken the if that's all they wanted.
So the U.S. military, like Trump could order nuclear strikes and just wipe out the population.
Yeah,
you understand?
Yeah, they could.
But what would be the point of that? Right?
I mean,
usually what a conqueror wants is they want to control the territory. They don't want to destroy
render
it uninhabitable or whatever. Okay, so now, of course, with the nuclear bombs, then you have fallout, so like nobody can even use the land.
Yeah, I wouldn't advocate nuclear bombs, but if you're at a point where you just want resources, which I could see in the future, you can envision a scenario where you don't really want to control people and the territory, you just want the resources.
No, I mean, I could see they become ever less and less important, right? Yeah, like pure physical resources, and the productivity of the people becomes more important. And that's why you try to take over.
I mean, I don't know if that's true in a world where we have diminishing resources, where we have finite resources, but exponential growth of an economy that demands that is based on physical resources. No, I mean, that's I don't see how that's the case.
No, there's no resource shortage.
Not yet, but over time, I mean, you have a finite resources, but you have an exponentially growing economy that's based on the physical resources.
People have been saying for like over a century, oh my God, we're running out of resources. And like the prices of natural resources keep going down. And just like that, the trend is towards human resources becoming more important relative to pure natural resources. Like that's what we're saying. Like you look at the price of labor versus the price of material resources.
You're looking at a snapshot in time, but I don't think you're considering the people have done studies
a long time. Right.
And I mean, I don't think
someday, like in a million years,
I don't think that's the case. Hold on. I have to argue this one because I mean, we just had a guy on who was an expert on resources. We were talking about the green transition and the amount of resources you need to transition from fossil fuel infrastructure to, say, you know, green energy infrastructure, talking about wind turbines and solar panels. And we don't even have enough for one generation of these green energy sources. The infrastructure that would be required, the batteries that would be required, et cetera, to replace the entirety of our fossil fuel economy with these alternative systems. And so that's just a single generation. I mean, that a single generation of those things is, you know, it's like 20 years, right? It's like the life cycle there. So I don't think it's obvious that we're not going to encounter resource wars. I mean, we've like oil. Currently, oil is, I think, our consumption of. I can't remember what the stat is, but I think we've reached peak oil, basically. That is.
I don't know if that's true because I've been hearing that all my life, that we're just about to reach peak oil. But anyway. Oil is going to become obsolete, right? We're going to replace it with nuclear power or something like that. Like, by the way, like, you know, I don't think we're going to go with solar and wind and water power or whatever. I think we're going to eventually admit that we need nuclear power. And then we'll eventually move over to that. And there's a ton of resources for that. There's like lots of uranium. I mean, not that there's that much, but you get a lot of power out of it. So, and then, you know, sometime after that, we'll develop nuclear fusion. And then that's going to be like, that's going to go for millions of years. Okay. But anyway, okay. Back to military. All right. So like, yeah, one country wants to take over another country, but by the way, like there are plenty of states that are much more powerful than some neighboring state and could just take them over. So the United States could, like Trump could take over Greenland.
But there's so many intersecting, conflicting like treaties and economic incentives, like the cost, even though yes, the United States militarily could probably invade Canada and, you know, yes, control the territory, but there isn't like the economic ramifications of that would be far outweighing the benefits of controlling Quebec, right?
Yeah. Okay. So it would not be economically a good move. It also would not be economically a good move to attack the anarchist society, right? Because, you know, there'd be a prosperous society. They'd be trading with your society, whatever. So it's just like the way that things work in the world as it is every country that's capable of attacking another country doesn't do so. Just like empirically, you know, there are 15 countries in the world, or at least there were when I wrote the book, that have no military. They don't have an army. Like the largest of these is Costa Rica.
Right.
They abolished their military in like the 1950s or something. And they weren't immediately taking over.
Yeah, I mean, if Costa Rica had oil, though, like, let's be honest.
Yeah, like if a country in the Middle East got rid of their military, man, they're going to be attacked.
Well, I mean, we saw what happened in Libya, right? They got rid of their nuclear program and pretty quickly thereafter.
And then we killed Gaddafi. Is that what happened? That's right. Yeah, like if you want to be protected from a government, you need to build a nuclear bomb.
I mean, it's not wrong. It's not a bad strategy.
Yeah.
Let's be frank.
But let's say to construct a nuclear bomb, you would probably need to have concentrated, focused state investment into a program.
That's right. Yeah. Like, it's expensive. It's difficult. But which is why nuclear weapons have not proliferated as we were expecting 50 years ago. But okay. But so the transition to a stable anarcho-capitalist kind of world probably requires first going through the world converting to democracy. And like one of the main reason why we're not invading Canada is probably that we're a democracy and so are they. And it would be unpopular with the voters. And the politician who started talking about invading Canada, he would be voted out, right? The voters do not like that. Okay. So what's probably going to have to happen is that the rest of the dictatorships in the world convert to democracies. And then anarchist societies are probably going to have to start in regions that are surrounded by democracies, right? Where it would be unpopular to start an aggressive war without provocation.
Yes, although democracies also aren't always ideologically aligned. And I think the notion of like democracies do not attack one another. Well, I mean, maybe in like a sort of a Atlanticist way, perhaps, but you know, Chile was a democracy. They elected Salvador Allende, and then you know the CIA overthrew Allende, and we installed Pinochet. There's still competing geopolitical interests, even if we're all like puppy kitten ice cream utopia democratic societies.
Yeah, I mean, well, you know, like imagine France going to war with Germany. Like that's like it's unthinkable.
It was also unthinkable.
It was like, not.
The Franco-Prussian War
60 years ago, right? But, we need, like, the world needs to advance to the point where it's like that, right? Which I think is a reasonable, feasible future, not immediate, right? So, like, we can't all, the United States cannot just all go anarcho-capitalist right now, right? Like, the world needs to, it's going to need some time to get there.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, that seems very utopic to me, to be honest.
A lot of stuff that seems utopian has happened. So like, just like, you know, democracy, I guess, would have seemed utopian like in the Middle Ages, right? And like, and you know, the society we're living in today is a utopia compared to what they had in the Middle Ages.
I mean, I think if you've got a world that is that basically is transitioning to anarcho-capitalism, where many states are deciding to basically reduce their statehood down to nothing and just transition to this purely free market-based system, I think eventually just devolves, like, you have disputes that don't resolve themselves through arbitration agencies, right? Like you eventually get disputes where the incentives start to change over certain resources or certain things, access to certain areas, where people start gradually building like coalitions and creating militaries. And the way I see it is it would just devolve. It would just, that cycle would repeat, you know, it just eventually then like, you know, they would all become anarchist and then one would become a state and then the incentive structure would all of a sudden change and it would just cycle through again. I don't know. That's just,
So my sense is like once you have government, it's hard to get rid of it. Okay, but if you could get rid of it, it would be hard to get it back. It'd be hard to set up a government, right? So like you have a protection agency and you're trying to monopolize a territory. It's like it's super hard to monopolize an industry unless you have the government to help you. Like the main way of monopolizing an industry is to get big enough that you can, afford to pay lobbyists and afford to pay politicians off to make laws that favor your company against other competitors, right? Okay, but there's probably going to be many protection agencies, right? That with overlapping jurisdictions,
they can work together, right? And they can, it might be in their self-interest, their rational self-interest to work together.
You have the emergence of like a Silovik type of culture,
So the protection agency try to start a cartel, but cartels are unstable because of public goods problem. So if you defect against the cartel and like try to undercut the cartel, then you get the benefits. Like you get more market share and then they lose, which is why this doesn't happen very much. If there's a small number of firms in a given industry, then plausibly they can establish a cartel. But if there's a very large number, then it's not going to work out. And the reason why there'd probably be a large number is firms tend to become less efficient as they get too large. So there's a most efficient size. There's a most efficient size, like in terms of cost per unit of whatever it is that you're producing, right? So there's a curve that's going to go, like the cost is going to go down and then it's going to go back up again as you become too large to be efficient. The most efficient size depends upon the fixed cost for the industry. The fixed costs are costs that you have to undertake if you're entering the industry at all. Okay. They don't increase with the production. Okay. So the fixed costs for the protection for the security company industry are really low. Like you don't have a big factory or anything like that. Okay. So that means that the most efficient size for a firm is probably going to be pretty small, which means there's going to be a very large number of firms, which means it's going to be super hard to try to establish a cartel or monopolize. Okay. That was a really, really quick version of the argument.
I mean, is that the only consideration though? I mean, you're just like isolating that variable of efficiency and the human response to it as a purely rational thing. I mean, if you look at it from that, if you reduce it down to that, I agree with you.
Well,
but so if you start to look at all the nuances of like what actually happens in the real world, is you've got different sort of alliances that built like just you have emotions, you have the inertia of the existing of people subscribing to this particular agency that's now kind of starting to monopolize. What are the costs of defecting from that? What are the kind of like subtle coercive things that are happening in the situation? Like there's a lot of nuance that's not, I don't think that's captured when you reduce it down to that more fundamental analysis.
Yeah, I mean, I'm talking about efficiency because like the more efficient firms are going to outcompete the less efficient ones. And right, it's not that everybody has this ideology of wanting to maximize efficiency. It's that if there are efficient and inefficient firms, the efficient ones are going to expand, the inefficient ones are going to shrink almost by definition. You know, you can imagine conceivable circumstances in which like maybe there's just some like really widespread ideology. And so like people just refuse to go to any firm that doesn't subscribe to this ideology, even if the firm is more efficient.
The non-woke anarcho-capitalist does.
Yeah. Right.
Okay.
That's a very plausible scenario, though. That's not just like an anomalous thing. That's like humans being irrational to that extent. Like, look at religion and like the strength of those kind of belief systems. I mean,
yeah, but
I think you're underestimating those kind of things.
And I think efficiency could also be interpreted in many forms. Like in the security agency concept, efficiency could be defined by brutality, like the ability of an agency to absolutely inflict horrendous punishments on those who trespass on like a barbershop's property or something like that. And then all of a sudden you're empowering an organization that's willing to, go complete ISIS on like a thief.
Yeah. What I meant by efficiency was economic efficiency, right? So, you provide the product at a low price, okay, which is what most people want. And by the way, you know, like crime victims are not more punitive than non-crime victims, right? So like, so it's actually not true that when you're a victim of a crime, then you want the maximum punishment for the criminal. Like, it's just empirically. But, oh, okay, anyway. So look, you can't imagine a society in which things will go badly. Where like, you know, there's just like this really widespread ideology that's malevolent. Okay, and then like people will only go to the protection agencies that have that ideology. But by the way, if you have a government, then also the government is going to have that ideology. And then
you know, not a government that's effectively regulated and that has effective, you know, well, institutions that check the incursion of religion into.
I mean, if you have a democracy, like they're going to circumvent it, right? But anyway, okay. Oh, okay. But also notice how religion is declining over time, right? So like, you know, it is plausible that we're going to get to a future world in which just like, you know, religion has less and less influence and, you know, ideology has less and less influence. This is, you know, it's not just me being utopian. It's like you can observe the trend.
But yet religion still plays an outs. Like, I agree that it's decreasing, but in the US, like the whole abortion debate, that's 100% influenced by religion. And the fact that reproductive rights were challenged a couple of years back, that's the undue influence of religious conservatism in this country playing onto society.
Well, I mean, so like, I don't think the answer to the abortion issue is obvious. Like, I don't think it's obvious that it's not wrong to have an abortion. So I'm not sure that was the wrong, right? But also like, just like as a purely legal decision, like Roe versus Wade was legally incorrect. It was a legally incorrect decision. But anyway, so, you know, like the reversal could be explained by, you know, the judges actually just like correctly interpreting the law. But it could also be explained by their, you know, there's a bunch of religious judges on the Supreme Court. But anyway, okay, just leaving that aside. The United States is a highly unusual society in many respects, and is a lot more religious than other similar modern liberalized democracies. But religiosity is decreasing in America as well. That will probably continue. No, I'm not saying that we're ready for anarcho-capitalism right now, but sometime in the future, you know, maybe we'll be ready for it. Right?
But I think that vacuum of we're defining religion in a particular way, but like people's desire to just believe, to subscribe to these ideologies that transcend themselves, to have these sort of tribal associations, like that's the more fundamental thing. And that I don't think is decreasing over time, because that's a basic human impulse, nature thing. Yeah. And so you're going to have that in an anarchist society, 100% in all anarchist societies. And it's the question of, you know, what form that takes. And it's almost, I think, a guarantee that you'll have some notable fraction of anarchist societies basically develop an ideology that will lend itself to ultimately, you know, statehood. I think that's like, that's almost, it's just, to me, that seems almost inevitable if you just look at, again, developments in human history and the role that religion has played in kind of the structure of societies.
There's religion, and then there's a more general phenomenon of tribalism. Like, okay, we're observing a bunch of tribalism, and like we've observed that for a long time. And then like maybe people are just like changing how they define their tribe. But I kind of think that tribalism is on the decline as well. And, you know, like, oh, we might not notice this because we only see what we've been observing in our lifetime, right? But, you know, it used to be that the neighboring tribes, like the tribalism was literally tribes. And it used to be that you would go to the neighboring tribe and literally murder the men over there just because they're from another tribe. Like, you know, it is kind of declining. And then, you know, just like go and kidnap the women. Okay, like murder the children as well. Okay, but like, so there's a kind of like liberal modern Western culture which is actually taking over the world. And they're sort of like older, more primitive cultures, you know, not meaning to insult them, but you know, which are just getting driven out. And like, you know, people who see the way that people live in modern Western societies, there's something attractive about that. Like, they, you know, you could continue living in this tribalist society, But then you'd like see how people are prospering in the West, and you can just see how it's better. And like, and that's why that culture is taking over. You know, there's this kind of like, you know, progress, there's human progress over time, right? Like there's progress in values and progress in social practices. And, you know, okay. You know, some people think, oh, there aren't really any objective moral facts, but there are, you know, there are values that are better than others. And then, and they appear to spread because people can see it.
Yeah. I mean, that's fair. I think that's a fair point, but I think, yeah, I think there's a game theory dynamic where, when things shift dramatically, like when all the people are starting to subscribe to like a particular set of values or something, then the incentive to like exploit those values now grows to the point where it's bound to be exploited, right? And so I think it's, I think it's the same. I think you're prone to the same issue where you're saying, oh, things are getting better and like the trajectory is good, but like it always, you know, the slope always ends up, you know, that you end up going in the sinusoidal wave because you need to have some sort of equilibrium. And like, there's always that room for exploitation that emerges when things seem to be going in like this really great direction. Right.
Yeah.
Okay. I don't know.
Well, so I'm not sure if this is what you're thinking of, but, you know, like let's say high trust societies are subject to being exploited by, like cynical manipulators, right? Let's say, and like our society is a relatively high trust society, right? Or, and you know, like maybe even higher trust societies would be maybe Sweden or Japan, and then that could be exploited by somebody who comes in and just like, you know, just makes deals with people who are trusting them, that just totally reneges and stuff like that. Okay, so, and you know, this is probably, you know, why psychopaths exist. They continue to exist, but they're a small percentage of the population. If they get to be too much, then it ceases to be adaptive. But when they're only a small percentage, nobody's ready for them. Okay. Mm-hmm. So anyway, like what we need is we need to develop mechanisms in our society that sort of like detect and punish exploiters, right? And so, okay, that's what we have. Now, you know, you might think, oh yeah, and that's why we need the government. But it doesn't necessarily have to be government. It's like, you know, the anarcho-capitalists are not like, we have a solution which is very similar, like everybody's solution to the problem of psychopaths or exploiters is kind of the same, which is like you kind of need somebody who's going to exert force against them. Mm. Like, there isn't really another solution, because if you're not willing to exert force, the people who are willing to exert force are going to win. Okay, so it's just a difference of whether the force wielders should be monopolistic or competitive. Should there be only one, or should there be more than one that compete with each other?
I mean, I agree that if you view it, if you reduce it down to that, I agree with you that there should be competing force, like enforcers.
You're an anarchist now.
But I don't. I think it fails to capture a lot of other nuances that don't make that obvious. Like it's. Yeah, I think a lot of things. I think anarchists. Models make more sense at a small scale, but I think at large scales, like the complexity of the system just calls for something else. And it's, I mean, we've touched on various aspects of that throughout this conversation, but I don't want to, I think we're almost reaching time here. I do want to just, I guess, maybe just touch on a final thing. And I do think there's a lot of valuable things to be learned and gained from your analysis of government. And even your prescription of anarcho-capitalism. And I think one of the interesting things you mentioned in the book is when people like criticize anarcho-capitalism, you know, they seem to do a more realistic job of evaluating kind of people's nefarious motives. But they don't do this when they look at government, you know, it's now all of a sudden like this more utopic, you know, vision of like, oh, these government officials, like they're working for me, not against me. But I think laying that out very clearly was really, really well done. It was really interesting. Is there anything else that you want to kind of highlight in terms of things that we can take from all the work that you've done to apply to political systems that we're going to have now? I mean, we're not going to get to anarcho-capitalism tomorrow. So for the time being, like, what do you think are the most important lessons we can derive from your work?
I don't know. Well, I think we should start to move in the direction, like we should start to have fewer things controlled by the government and more things controlled by the market. Okay. Now, you know, so you have to do this in the intelligent way. Like, you need to make sure that there is competition, right? Like, you know, like the main advantages of the market, there's competition and then there's voluntariness, meaning that, you know, the customers have to decide to buy your product and there are other providers that they could choose. Like, those two things are really important. And like, we don't get that with most government provision. We need to try to figure out how to do that. But by the way, even without abolishing the government, we could move closer to that. Like, we could have more areas patrolled by private security guards. And like, you know, the government can outsource some of the policing duties, right? And then we could just try expanding that and see how it goes, right? And if it's working, we could expand it more.
Seeing how it goes, I think, with regards to public safety is a little bit of a cynical prescription. I think it's just a little bit. Like,
Andre's not going to let it go. We're not going to let you have any.
Yeah, but sorry. The floor is yours. Yeah.
There's some cases where, you know, even the government will hire private security guards, right? We have private security guard companies right now. We have more private security guards than government police in the country. There are a bunch of people who are hiring them because the government doesn't give enough security. Okay, like, yeah, you know, let's just try expanding that. And you could have a similar thing about the courts. Like, let's try having more cases handled by private arbitrators. There are some cases where the government courts will refer you to arbitration. I think there's some automobile insurance disputes where the court will tell you to first try to go to an arbitrator. Like, you know, let's just sort of expand this, try to get more cases handled by arbitration. And so we don't need to abolish everything right away, right? We can sort of like move in that direction. And then if it works, we could move more further, you know.
There it is. More competition. I like it. I mean, yeah, I don't necessarily disagree. In a vacuum, in isolation, I don't. I don't disagree with that.
Adopt the anarcho-capitalism of your mind.
Yeah, where if people want to find more of your work, where can they go to?
So I have a blog called Fake News, which is spelled FAKENOUS, which is on Substack. So, you know, you can go read that. Also, I've got a bunch of books, you know, which you should order on Amazon.
And we will link to some of those in the show notes. But,
you know, like,
big thanks.
Problem of Political Authority.
Yeah,
read that.
Yeah, it's a, you know what? It's such a well-written book. The clarity of your writing is really impressive, given the abstractness of the topic. So I do encourage people to check it out, because I think there's so many valuable insights, regardless of whether you agree with the conclusions or not. So, yeah. But yeah, big thanks to you, Dr. Humer. We really appreciate you coming on.
Oh, thanks for having me. It's great talking to you.